are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 21st, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Post political reporter Dave Weigel on what happened in Georgia's 6th District, lessons learned, what happens going forward. Also on the program tonight, speaking of health care, or rather tax cuts disguised as health care reform, moderates are in the so-called moderates in the Senate, I should say, are busy building that structure so they have something to cave. Meanwhile, the case file in the Philando Castile shooting reveals systemic problems with policing. Trump to cut housing aid, except for a program that he makes money off of. Surprise, surprise. And Mueller is closing in on the Felix Sater connection that has been my ballywick since talking, I guess, to Wayne Barrett over the summer last year. The late, great Wayne Barrett. Meanwhile, newly FOIA documents show that Chelsea Manning's leaks caused no real harm to national security. The EPA is looking to buy out nearly 10% of its agency by summertime. Seattle now serving coffee with the tears of libertarians upset about the minimum wage increases not hurting employment results.
Hopefully they don't have up-to-date sprinkler systems. Something for Meghan McCardle to be happy about.
And apparently the Queen doesn't want Trump to get a state visit. All this and more on today's program.
I guess I have to run for king then now.
Yes. We'll see about that.
What bedroom did she stay in this hotel?
Oh, geez. So, look, I think people are probably aware that John Ossoff lost in the election last night. What was it, three and a half points? And additionally, which we had really not talked about at all, because I think there was a perception that it wouldn't be close. But there was a race in South Carolina last night where where there was a lot less voter turnout, and the Democratic contender there in South Carolina's fifth, a guy named Archie Purnell, who apparently was a former Goldman Sachs, but was running a much more sort of muscular Democratic, almost old-timey Democratic campaign, came in. Lost, but came in a little bit closer. I mean, we will talk about that with Dave Weigel, if there's any lessons to be garnered there. Again, as you've probably heard, if you've listened to the fun half, John from San Antonio has pointed out, as many others have, that there are somewhere between, depending on how you calculate it, whether it's based upon how close Clinton came or won in a congressional district, or how close the prior congressional elections were between the Democrat and the Republican. There's somewhere between, I don't know, 90 some odd and 80 some odd House districts which should be a closer race than these two. You were talking about that Georgia district, at least in South Carolina, I imagine even more. But there were it was an R+8 district. So a heavily Republican district. With that said, that doesn't necessarily mean that it was out of reach and that Ossoff ran the appropriate campaign. You're hearing voices as far afield as Matt Iglesias saying, could be time for the Democrats to actually get and run on an actual proactive message. So not to say that you shouldn't run on anything else, but an actual proactive message. I know that seems quaint.
I think Donald Trump is mean, and we should do something about the deficit.
Well, here's the thing. They didn't even run on Donald Trump as mean.
That's true. They said we should do something about the deficit was actually the closest message that I got from him.
It was, they didn't mention Donald Trump. It was a very narrowly tailored message.
She was like, you're a gay terrorist who doesn't live in the district. And he was like, I think we should cause wasteful spending.
Yeah. I think there was definitely a sort of like a four corners quality to that campaign that didn't work out. But more importantly, the question is, what we really have lost here, most specifically, is the intimidation factor in terms of what it means for voting for healthcare. And in that respect, it is most problematic. You're starting to see outside groups now start to pressure the Republican Senate. Let's play this ad. I don't know. I sort of like it.
It's cute.
Michael thought it was sort of dumb, but I think this type of thing is going to cut through. This is an AARP, and maybe that's why I like it. Because I'm in the pocket of big AARP. In fact, I think I got a discounted membership. I think I'm eligible now. Maybe I'm not. But here is the AARP featuring a man talking to a squirrel. At least the squirrel's doesn't know how to talk. Just knows how to squeak.
Hi there. My friend Charlie here just got back from Washington, D.C., where he did a little snooping around Capitol Hill. Now, he brought back this briefcase containing details of every scheduled hearing and debate of the Senate's new health care bill. Nobody else has this. This is a Charlie exclusive. Charlie, it's empty. Well, that can't be right. No hearings or debates on a bill that will affect millions of Americans? And what about all the bad stuff in it? The age tax, the cuts to Medicaid, giving billions to drug and insurance companies, and price gouging people with pre-existing conditions. Surely that can't still be in the bill, can it? They're not showing anyone the bill? Come on. Well, I'm calling my senators, and you should do the same. Tell them our health care should not be decided behind closed doors.
I won't stop until they hashtag show me the bill, squeaks the squirrel. I actually think it's a pretty good ad because it just delivers a lot of information in a very cute squirrely package.
Forgive me. Did you see the way he had a squirrel and the squirrel was like a detective and he knew about what was wrong with the film?
I thought it was very funny.
And the man was talking to him. That was what. Now, I explained to my children that.
How did the squirrel get all the information? It's unbelievable. That squirrel is a very intelligent squirrel. It's a very intelligent squirrel. And, the squirrel never gets the credit for carrying such a large briefcase all the way back from Washington. It couldn't have been possibly easy at all.
Sort of like an operative, but also an investigative reporter.
I actually think it was a decent ad. At the very least, people are getting out there. And again, call your senators, regardless of their party, and do not believe your senators in Ohio, in Nevada, in Pennsylvania. Do not believe your senators in Maine or in Arizona that they are concerned about this stuff. They don't care. They honestly are just setting up a structure that they can then cave. We'll talk more about that later in the program. Take a quick break. Come back with Dave Weigel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the Washington Post. Dave, what is your, are you a political correspondent, political reporter? What is your title over there?
I think national correspondent is what we use the most because the beat involves covering a lot of political movements, and that's not always election-based. That does involve going around everywhere.
And also, the author, you have a book that just was released on prog rock. Is that right?
That is correct. The Show That Never Ends, my book about progressive rock, which I don't know how it's selling well so far. I don't think I'm going to beat Bill O'Reilly's hit killing Jethro Tull, but it's been selling well, and I've been on a cross country tour hawking people. So yeah, just came out Tuesday. Please buy it.
All right, folks should pick that up. We will not be discussing that today, but...
I think it's the biggest story in the country, but I mean, we can just talk about something else, yeah.
We could, we'll talk, but we will definitely, maybe we should definitely, I need to read the book first. And so, now, listen, I appreciate your CIA handlers allowing you to join us today.
They're pretty good. I mean, I have to take a trip to Venezuela a little bit later today. I can't really discuss it, but... move that ahead, and they gave me the license to go on the show today, so I'm very grateful.
So, you had a piece about the OSIF election yesterday morning. And it was before the results came in, and basically arguing that the the lesson from the Ossoff election is that all politics are tribal. What did you mean by that?
I meant that despite this race coming down on TV to John Ossoff living several miles outside of it, he ran as the guy who was going to specifically represent the district, and he ran TV ads with local businessmen he talked to who endorsed him. Ossoff ran with Democrats and, you know, capital D Democrats in D.C. say Democrats should do, which is focus on local issues, get them to give a reason for people to cross party lines and vote for him. And Handel and the PACs behind her ran completely negative against basically an election result that would make liberals happy. And then that's how I would sum it up. There was very little reason to vote for her. She was kind of a fairly competent Secretary of State, lost a couple of big state elections, was not the person Republicans wanted in this race, was opposed by the Club for Growth, et cetera, but just ran as the candidate who would make liberals sad. And there literally was campaign mail in the first round of the election, which, as we all know, lasted about 7 years, which showed a stock footage of a man crying. And it was that simple. It was Georgia Republican Party saying, please vote to make people sad. That is the only reason you need to turn out and vote. Betting that there are enough Republicans who are going to overlook everything happening in Washington to do that, and betting successfully.
And we have actually some ads that you pointed out from your piece, and the ones that are we have a couple of still images that basically one where John Ossoff is pulling off his face essentially, and underneath it is Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
And I mean, how well known is Nancy Pelosi in that district? And because there's a dynamic here where, and we should say that John Ossoff, who launched his campaign by saying, I'm going to make Donald Trump upset, which, at least has some logic to it insofar as, like, I could be the second to last vote that he needs for healthcare or something to that effect. But he abandoned the anti-Trump stuff. And, I mean, so compare the knowledge that people have in that district between Trump and Nancy Pelosi. I mean, how is it that Nancy Pelosi is this effective? What's going on with the conservative mind, I guess, that Nancy Pelosi and just the idea of, like, you'll make liberals cry that effective?
Well, it's about who votes. It's not about every human being living in the district. It is about the fact that this district was redrawn in 2011 to elect a Republican forever. So whatever else happens, there's a preponderance of voters there who are used to coming out every election voting whoever the Republican is. And so what the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is the super PAC, basically backed by Paul Ryan, financially backed by Sheldon Adelson and Paul Singer and those people, their strategy was first take a poll. The poll found that those reliable Republican voters knew who Nancy Pelosi was and did not like her. They were about twice as likely to vote for somebody who said he or she was going to support Paul Ryan as would support Pelosi. And they tried to make the referendum on that. And it was striking to me because this is not how Democratic politics work. I mean, I've covered this stuff for a while. I don't recall a Democratic ad warning people that such and such candidate would be a lockstep vote for John Boehner, right? Since Gingrich really left office, it's not been part of the message. And what was also striking, there was very little content to this message. It was not, if you put Pelosi in power, she's going to do this and this. It was generically, she has an agenda of higher taxes, and she has an agenda that would make America less safe. So they bound this up in a very, and I can't use the word tribal, which is a little bit loaded. It was tribal because it did not rely a lot on the facts. It also, the word association, I would say, that was potent in a way that I don't think Democrats appreciated. Ossoff, again, was born in this district, a fairly successful family, moved back to the area, but not quite in the district. So they're able to say that he was not living in the district. Okay, that's one point. The opening that gave them, which was kind of sneaky, but, there's no take back in politics. You want to be sneaky, and it works for you, you do it. The ads all implied that he was a puppet of people outside the state, of Californians. There were several ads showing actors playing stereotypical loopy gay-looking Californians.
Actually, we have that ad.
Yeah.
This is the ad where, and it's, you know, I'm trying to put myself in the mind of somebody from this district in Georgia. I can see all the, like you're making all those Obama, young Obama liberals cry. I see that motif in this. Maybe just the San Francisco just implies gay. I guess I don't see the gay, but maybe they perceive it just because it's San Francisco. But here is that ad.
Hi, Georgia. San Francisco just wanted to say thank you.
We already have Nancy Pelosi as our congresswoman. Now you're going to give us John Ossoff as our congressman.
We're proud that California is the leading funder of the John Ossoff campaign.
He's one of us.
We're really excited that John Ossoff likes higher taxes.
Pelosi and Ossoff weaken the military. ISIS? They're overrated.
San Francisco loves them some John Ossoff.
Congressional Leadership Fund is responsible for the content of this advertising.
There was a lot of hippy-dippy quality to that, right? Like they gave the peace sign was all over there.
It reminds me of one of those Weekly Standard covers where every time the left is betrayed, it's like a 60-year-old guy at a Dead and Company show,
right,
with Birkenstocks on. So it was more left-wing, and you heard the way I described there. You know, you and I, having been awake for more than 10 minutes, remember Trump was going to kill ISIS off and within 30 days being president. But in that ad and in all their ads, they pushed the onus back on the Democrats to say, well, you know, we're on the cusp of being ISIS unless you elect a Democrat who, I don't know, it's kind of an underpants gnome strategy, right? Step one, elect Democrat. Step two, blank. Step three, ISIS wins. I'm not quite sure how it's supposed to work.
Well, the idea is it's almost just...
It's notably dumber than a lot of campaigns I've covered. That's why I focused on it.
And it seemed... I mean, I don't know. How do you... I mean, obviously, it worked insofar as handle one. But
right.
It's obviously very difficult to sort of like tear this apart and say this... this was determinate, that was determinate, because we are talking about a district, like you say, that was not only gerrymandered in 2011 to win, but since 1992, the district has not had a race that has been, the difference has been less than plus 16, right? And now this is an open seat, so that there's a different calculation there. What do you make of the argument that Matt Iglesias made last night, I guess maybe, or this morning, that the Democrats need a larger national message? I mean, because if you just sort of generically step back and say, Handel ran a national message, it's not a terribly sophisticated one, and it's not a policy-oriented one, but it was one that basically said, Ossoff will be part of the broader liberal agenda. What about the idea of Ossoff not necessarily making a national negative message, although he could have tied her to Trump, but just one that basically sort of says, like, we're going to do, you know, I'm going to add to doing this in the broader body politic?
It's a good question, because I covered the campaign a little bit. A lot of us in the Post took turns going down there. The Ossoff campaign wanted to win the first round because it was going to be lower turnout, and they came closer, people thought. Frankly, I've not been very interested in spinning for Democrats on this, but historically, if a race goes to a runoff in Georgia, the Democratic vote collapses, and it didn't collapse. I mean, they held it to 48%. But so what they were trying to do, what they thought they were succeeding in doing until like about 10 days ago, of a very long race, a 9-week race, was running so that Republican voters, for all the negative ads they were seeing, were at least also seeing that John Ossoff was a moderate guy who cared about the district and was going to work with all sides to get stuff done. That's the way they put it. And it fell off because of just kind of the angering up the blood of these Republican voters who vote every election. You just had he won young voters, but there are these older voters in that district who've never voted for Democrats who were hoped once more to just come out and vote. And the thing that was striking was they're not voting for anything. Typically, so the knock on a lot of politics, which is weird to me, it gets totally backwards. It's bad to be transactional. You know, Republicans will say Democrats only get votes by promising to give people things. The flip side of that is Republicans are not promising to get people anything. And they were not really defending the agenda in Washington or the achievements in Washington. They were just saying, this will make liberals sad and you hate liberals.
Well, that's a promise.
That was the extent of it.
I mean, that's a promise.
It will make them sad. It did make them sad. That was accurate.
And it is. I mean, on some level, I mean, look, if you have no judgment towards what they're getting, it is. I happen to believe that, you know, so much of this is written, so much of what makes up the conservative movement is a certain cultural aggrievement. I mean, you're giving them something like it's a win. It's like you're going to be able to spike the football. That doesn't necessarily mean that that works on the Democratic side. And I guess
you were asking about Matt Glaser's point.
Yeah.
And I think what was missing there, I described in semi-defended alpha strategy, was missing was not an anti-Trump argument, but an argument about how Trump was betraying voters on what they had expected from him. And this is something Democrats have been getting ready to do, but not doing in every election so far this year, of saying it's not just, you know, the ads that said Trump is gross, Trump curses in front of your kids, Trump made fun of a disabled guy, they didn't move people. Republicans were like, all right, fine, they came up voting anyway. What Democrats have not done is said, Trump promised to do this. Let's say he promised to bring your factory back, didn't do that. Promised to give you health care, didn't do that. Promised to beat ISIS, didn't do that. It's and I don't know why they didn't tie that together. That was clearly, there was a way to make an anti-Trump argument to Republicans who in the district did not like Trump and did not like the health care bill that might have overwhelmed this sense. They just had to come out and make Pelosi sad, but they didn't really try.
You know, it's I've seen an argument that in many ways Ossoff ran a similar campaign to where Clinton was critiqued, in that there was an attempt to appeal to sort of the Mitt Romney style voters. And I think I saw a tweet storm. I think it was by Zach Carter, who had argued that, like, look, you're trying to get sort of those who, you know, for lack of a better term, the aristocracy, right? This is the suburban Republican voter to be just personally disgusted by Trump, like a Mitt Romney. Uh-huh. We imagine Mitt Romney seeing, you know, Trump as horribly uncouth, and that they're going to appreciate.
Mitt Romney, who also sent out a fundraising letter for Handel. That's how conservative he is about this.
Well, I mean, but that proves the point, though, right? Is that you're not going to move those Republican suburban voters. They're not going to vote based upon their own personal sort of like affront, you know, to how uncouth this guy is. You need to make some type of like substantive case.
Well, not just uncouth. That's what I'm saying. Is the opening the Democrats didn't take is that it's not just that Trump is the guy you didn't like before. It's that he's already failing on what he promised to run on.
Well, that, yeah, no,
and
no,
he's
I
not
think
delivering,
we're
and they didn't put that out. Yeah,
we're in agreement in that regard. I mean, and he didn't even make the Trump is uncouth, but there's a it's almost like he was trying to put that out there by being so Mitt Romney-ish himself, right? I mean, like he was above the fray.
And the argument was the way he would mention Trump was very subtle. He just talked about civility in our politics and sense. I mean, but when I saw him, he had a line of bringing back sense over nonsense. And it was very clear that he was talking about how it seemed like D.C. was spinning out of control. But in a way that the Democrats never were able to get working for them, Republicans can tell their voters, oh yeah, nothing's working like it should. That's because liberals are bad. Vote against liberals. That just did not work. And I think some of that is just down to voting patterns. So I do think this election bolstered the argument that you see on the DSA Red Rose Twitter, that you got to stop pretending that there's this moderate Republican voter who's going to come over to you. They might not love Trump, but they're going to be humble that argument. Look instead at these other special elections where Democrats increased their margin by 20 points and lost, but ran like more pointed campaigns and were trying to change the electorate.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Archie Purnell. I mean, we barely even mentioned him on this program because there was not much reporting, but no one seemed to take that race seriously.
I went down there. I was there for him. Not last night, but I went down there to cover it, yeah.
So what was your sense of that race? I mean, he's one who closed the gap between Trump and Clinton, who outperformed Clinton, we should say.
Right. It was the Republican vote just kind of collapsed, and the Democratic vote stayed pretty stable. So it wasn't clear that he was growing votes, but he was getting people out of there.
Do you think that was because the Republicans were confident about it and didn't run the Archie Purnell is actually going to be, you know, carrying water for Nancy Pelosi type of thing, or what?
That's a good question. I think so. Here's what's telling about that race is I talked to Republicans in the windup, and they know that I'm going to be writing about any Democrat. Let's say have a shot, and they'll make fun of me if the guy loses. So this keeps happening. But then I said, look, for background, I cover Purnell. If you guys do engage, I mean, what do you think is the case against him? And they would say, oh, we would run against how he worked for Goldman Sachs. He was a tax compliance guy for Goldman Sachs. And so how telling is that? That if they were in a pinch, they were going to run against the Democrat for working for the company that supplied the entire Trump financial team.
Right.
And that's the thing. Like, they're not defending what they're governing on. And they're not defending the merits of how they're governing. They're just looking for what will alienate voters, or what will alienate the other team's voters. That's literally it. I mean, I'd give them more credit if there was credit to give. But that's been the strategy.
What do you think accounts for the Democrats making this mistake? I mean, I've seen critiques that center around the fact that the Democratic Party has a fairly small cadre of political consultants who keep failing consistently. And I don't know. I mean, everything I understand in the world, I understand from working at Air America. And I certainly saw, sort of the same crew of consultants coming through there that, you know, the how it can be. I mean, how is it that the Republicans have more effective consultants in that way? I mean, what is it? What is there something sort of structurally or systemic, or is it just that, like, there's a lack of imagination or fear or what?
I think Republicans trust their base more, and not that they have great respect for them, but they know how to turn them out. Whereas a few elections now, Democrats have gone after the schools of getting these voters who they know are dissatisfied Republicans, and maybe there's a way to win them over, and they don't have as much faith that they can turn the base out in the numbers that would overwhelm Republicans. That critique, again, I think it's a critique of lesson making, and it's hard to deny it because this is the latest failure of a different strategy. So I don't think the liberal voters think of the same way as conservatives necessarily. There does seem to be more of a willingness among Republican voters to overlook everything wrong with a candidate. So, I mean, just look at the kind of the purity testing that goes on in Democratic politics, right? There is the fact that Ossoff was not for single payer. He was getting beaten up on Twitter all the time for that. Handel, meanwhile, was like a notoriously bad public official who was attacked every time she ran, was beaten up by the Club for Growth for wasting money. And you saw no Republicans criticize her on that. Like they were all on the team. As soon as they need to be on the team, they're on it.
Right. So we have sort of the ongoing, and that's always been a problem, obviously, on the left. I mean, I don't necessarily know it's one that we could or would want to necessarily deal with. But I guess I'm just curious from a strategy standpoint. I mean, when you go down there and you see the people running the campaign, have you seen those people before? I mean, is there how many different people are there who do this type of thing? You know, I mean, are we talking about there are 5,000 Democratic operatives, paid operatives who go in? Or are we talking like there's, I don't know, a couple hundred and the same people keep turning up? I mean, because I just remember seeing this piece in the New York Times the other day. The Democratic Party in split screen, right? The base wants it all, and the establishment just wants to win. Well, I mean, if their job number one and only job is to win, like, they're not doing it. You know, it's like, it's one thing to say, like, man, they're just getting it. But this is a classic case of, from my perspective, this is a Democrat I'm not going to particularly like, but I'm going to like him better than Tom Price, because but the idea was, you say that because this guy's going to win, and they run a strategy where they don't even use anything. It's almost a strategy that had no context, both in terms of like spatial or temporal, right? There's no Donald Trump. There's no financial crisis. There's nothing. It's just sort of floating in time without any context whatsoever, his campaign message seemed to have.
Yeah, I think it comes from a learned helplessness that was learned at the end of the Obama years. And so you raise a really good question about the consultants, and I frankly need to do more work identifying who's doing what. I know that Mothership is the media consulting firm that ran all of the hilariously panicky Ossoff direct email,
right,
saying, you know, Ossoff Ossoff loses, give us money. You know, we warned you he was going to lose, we need to give us money. Those people that have some stuff answered for it. In terms of the consultants doing this, I'm not sure if it's so I want to know the people who are responsible, but I think the theory is shared by lots of people, which is we're going to do focus group or we're going to do a poll, and Hillary made the mistake. Focus group says that 80% of people are opposed to this thing Trump did, and it says only 60% are opposed to this other thing. So we're going to hit the 80%. And there's not an appreciation of what people feel intensely about, two, what voters who have been on the sidelines feel intensely about. So the anecdotal stuff I saw from Georgia that was mind-blowing was just, you know, young voters who could be activated and just were convinced there wasn't a difference between the parties, they were going home, whereas Republicans who were being told by Ossoff that there wasn't going to be that much of a problem for, you know, if you're a conservative, you're going to love them anyway, were so easy to activate just based on ISIS and Pelosi. And those were not, if you were to ask a Democrat what you think are the issues that might motivate a Republican, you know, 6 months ago, I'm not sure if they'd say, oh, of course, well, you know, the fact that Nancy Pelosi has been out of power for 8 years, that's going to get people burning up again. Now, I don't want to be contradictory, because Republicans did discover how toxic she was in their own polling. I just mean that they know what's going to make people intense, and a Democrat seems to want to reach for the stars and get an issue that's going to hit the broadest number of people. But this is about not reaching them. It's about voting. And there are people who will hear that message and maybe nod, but not vote, who they keep reaching, or nod and then vote for the other person. A lot of it happened with Hillary.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we've had, I'm thinking of a guest, her name escapes me now, but she was a labor organizer and said, you know, the problem that we have on the left is that we're messaging more than we're organizing. And that's indicative. It's one thing to sort of reach people with something that they vaguely agree with. It's another to motivate them to get out of their house and go vote in a special election. I mean, I'm on, you know, I know you're on these email lists too. I'm on an email list with communications people where there's people on that list who are like, you know, I to be honest with you, I wasn't motivated to go vote for Ossoff. I mean, these are, if you can't motivate anybody who's on an email listserv about politics to go vote for your candidate in this situation, that's a pretty you failed in some fundamental way. And the other thing that occurs to me is the reason why you could never run against John Boehner and even Paul Ryan to a certain extent is there's no infrastructure that exists in that district or frankly any districts out there where the voters have a narrative that exists in between elections. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like the Republicans, Laura Ingraham, Mark Levin, the whole crew down there, they are constantly have, Nancy Pelosi probably feels like she's in state all the time.
Well, a good example of that is, not, let me truncate his story. you know, it's 2010, March, and the Democrats have been resurrecting the Senate version of the health care bill and they got it passed through the House. And Pelosi tells this group of county officials about all the good things in the bill and then says, you have to pass the bill so you can see what's in it away from the controversy. And 7 years later, long after she's taken out of power, I will hear elected members of Congress, not like just voters who, God love them, but sometimes you expect to have a Fox News knowledge, elected members of Congress who are sure that the Democrats did not let people see what was in their bill because Pelosi said that. And just the level of, I'm not saying anything that would be optimistic, the level of inculcating a message, like Democrats have nothing to compete with that.
I received an email argument from a guy my audience knows as Indie Mike, who quoted that actually 6 weeks ago from me, and made me go and look into the broader context in which she said that, and it was completely a phrase. It was just basically like, you know, once we get past this, people really need to sit down and understand what's in it.
Saying like, on TV, all you're hearing about is like death panels, and come on, they're not it. What you're going to get is subsidies and kids on their parents' insurance, yada, 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 which turned out to be somewhat true. I mean, now that they're trying to undo the law, all that stuff is popular.
Yeah,
and,
indeed.
But my point is that, like, you have Republicans for 7 years, and at all levels of media being told she said something else. So what the attempt you hated, some of that hate is based on falsehoods. And, I don't think you have the same thing. At the moment, polling will show that broadly across the country, Paul Ryan is less popular than Nancy Pelosi. Neither is popular. He's at like 32% or something. He's 35. You can't get people motivated against him. And they've tried for 7 years to do it. And I think the difference is that with the exception of some of MSNBC, and I think what you do, and a lot of online writing, there's not the coverage of Paul Ryan. It's like this amnesic,
right.
roundabout. People keep no matter what he does. 6 months later, he's like, "Oh, yeah, Paul Ryan's gonna has a poverty plan. He's gonna get people to take seriously." He's just like he gets a million mulligans in a way from the mainstream media, and that is not something that Pelosi sometimes will mention it. He's never even been on the cover of Time magazine. I don't want to get into too many tangents here, but
right.
The way that there is nothing comparable to the way that she has been negatively covered in terms of how the Republican leadership's covered. And the penetration with the voters who are hard for Democrats to turn out, it's not there. I think when people sweat about the Bernie-Hillary fight lasting into year four on Twitter, that's a reason why. It's people who could be spending that time to learn anything. Instead of focusing on what Republicans are doing, they're gonna beat up the DNC one more time.
I wonder what just the and I know you don't know this, but the numbers for the sort of the clearance for Sinclair Media and Fox News and the town hall radio guys and like the
Salem, yeah.
Yeah, Salem. I mean, it must be just bathing in that there, and there's just this constant. I mean, it all sort of reminds me of like of like the Red Sox for years they wouldn't win, and my theory was just that having grown up in Boston that people would just like to read about the Red Sox all year round, even if it meant that the team was falling apart, because they'd be able to read about it in the Globe on the off year of the election. And on some level it's like there's a quality to that about the Democrats broadly speaking, but there's also just sort of the constant narrative that is there. So that when you have a special election, you don't have to build anything. Like all the tools are already there on, you know, everything, all the infrastructure is there. They just have to activate it, where it seems very different. And also in the Parnell race that you can't activate the base of the Democratic Party as easily because there's no infrastructure there.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I think that's basically what's been happening. And this is why... Tom Perez agreed with Keith Ellison about this, that you need to fuel these parties again. To the extent they did invest in South Carolina, it was donating to the state party and also doing a mailer to black voters who had not been activated in the last midterm. And they actually got a couple of results of that. What you need is active parties. The place where kind of keep helping the Wisconsin Curling Tournament in the DNC race was look at Minnesota. If you look at Minnesota, it has a lot of similarities with a lot of Midwestern states that have swung really hard right. But it has an extremely active, a volunteer-based Democratic Party with good leadership and even super rural counties. And they're able to keep electing these rural Democrats because they're in conversation with voters all the time.
Right.
The places where they're getting hammered. And that's the thing with, I don't think Democrats should spend today spinning that this secretly was a great election for them. If they do stick around, I'm not thinking they're just John Ossoff packs up and moves 5 minutes up the road and stays in the district and they try to build a party. I do think you'll get to a point in, you know, maybe even 18 months where there's now a strong enough Democratic Party in Cobb County, Georgia, that they can compete for local office and win. And actually, I was talking to the chair of the Orange County, California Democrats a couple weeks ago, and she's been saying, you know, they have all these people running in trying to run for Congress. It'll be like 10, 11 people for one seat where they couldn't get anyone to run a year ago. And she's been telling some of them, look, this is going to be tough, but she's living in a town where, despite Hillary winning by 20 points, everyone on the state council is a Republican. Maybe you should run for that. And having some success for that. But that is after years of attrition. And so they're trying to build that up in a instant sea monkey kind of way, like for all the Democrats are doing in Georgia. That's not quite, in none of these states is enough. I think that's why Montana scared Republicans so much in a way that Kansas and South Carolina did not. If we're talking about the races that were not, obviously, in the states that broke for Trump huge, right, or the district that did. Montana has a good Democratic Party that stays connected and wins things and knows how to message. So you need to build that. But I'm talking about party leadership. There's nothing like Fox and Friends, which is by far my favorite TV show. Like, forget Better Call Saul. Fox and Friends is incredible because if you watch that show, you are getting beamed updates from another earth where everything Trump is doing is going incredibly well.
Right.
And every scandal he's accused of is fake. And that, if you don't think that has a long-term effect on reliable elderly conservative voters, then you're nuts. I mean, you can't buy that kind of connection. Multiply that by every radio show and every local TV channel.
Right.
I think it's very tough to get out of that. This is why, I mean, just by covering this, I don't think my own personal politics changed a lot in the last year. By covering this, that's why I become so much more sympathetic to the Bernie style of argument. Not that every Bernie policy needs to be adapted, but that you can't compete for this unless the poor voters who never turn out are convinced that there's something to turn out for, and they're contacted by Democrats who will tell them, yes, okay, they'll let this one, we'll do it.
Dave Weigel, Washington Post national correspondent, also author of The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Prog Rock, available today. What's that? And one of the premier CIA agents working in journalism today. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, I'm off to Caracas. Don't ask what it's about. I'll see you later.
I understand. All right. We should play you out with this. Hold on. All right, Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, Dave Weigel's theme song.
Wow, you're such a committed shill that even Dave Weigel, you go to the mat for. I mean, come on, at a certain point, you gotta have some ethics, brother.
I know. All right, folks.
Like Nancy
sorry about
Pelosi?
The phone there. He was literally running for a train, I think. Like, literally running. I think at one point.
Wait, you like Nancy Pelosi now, along with Dave Weigel, is that right?
It's
I mean, at a certain point, where's your conscience? Rachel Maddow goes Russia, 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 and you go whatever the opposite of
I just pick up a fork and eat it all up.
I mean, but at a certain point, what I'm trying to say is liberals and progressives need to come together. Because we're in this war, man. And there's serious YouTube revenue at stake, and we're going to lose the Congress if we don't come together. So you got to stop being a shill. Can we just come together and you can acknowledge that Kim.com blew up the whole story and that you're a shill? You and other lesbian black pundits are shilling for the Democratic Party. And if you could just stop, call for an investigation of the Seth Rich murder.
Nobody on this half of the show knows what you're talking about.
Oh. That's a good point. Well, no, unless they watch it on YouTube. This is YouTube-based humor.
Well, folks,
Everybody likes Bernie or Bus Bill, even just, if they have no idea.
No, that's true. People do. But it's, yes.
All right, I'll see you on the fun half.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. A reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. Members should have gotten an email.
Members know what I was talking about.
Well, members definitely know what you're talking about. Because of a phone call we got yesterday in the fun half. But not only as, you know, when you support the program, you're obviously supporting the free program. And as a way of saying thank you to you, we give you an extra bonus material every day. Hour and a half, sometimes 14 hours, whatever it is. And we also have, for members, an exciting new extra bonus, which is the behind-the-scenes video of the live show we did for the PodFest, which has now been emailed to all members. If you're a member and for some reason you didn't get it, somebody emailed me, maybe our email went into your spam filter or bounced, or you gave us a secret fake email or whatever it is, send us an email at Majority Reporters and we'll hook it up for you. You can see that it's art. It's art. It's not I'm not saying that what we did was art, but the portrayal of what we did, it's really a piece of art. Why are you looking like that, Kelly?
I feel like it might be my coming out party.
And I got to say, yeah, it's like, Matt, there's some really creepy, like in the dark web, there's some really creepy Matt fan sites that have grown out of this.
It's already bootlegged on those sites.
I don't even want to...
be clear, you're straight.
Well, whatever, it doesn't matter. You don't have to foreclose any fans. Who knows? He's so young.
He could change his mind.
Well, it's not a question of changing his mind. It's just like
discovering myself.
He came from North Dakota. Like it could have felt like pressure, and there could be time for I don't know.
Okay.
Anyways, folks. Your support is what keeps this show on the air. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com, and you can join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Plenty more to talk about in the fun half. We'll see you there, 646-257-3920, if you want to be a part of the program. Be right back.
Sad. She said no.